Welcome to Life Sciences and Science Life, a science podcast of the University of Vienna's Doctoral School of Pharmaceutical, Nutritional and Sport Sciences.
Our team of PhD candidates, along with various experts in the field, talk about current advances in science while exploring the challenges and triumphs of PhD life. Today's topic is drug development, AI, and saying no. This is Sarah.
My name is Agnes.
And we're here to tell you all about it.
Welcome to this episode. We're here today with Christian and Andrea from the Pharmaceutical Chemistry Department. And today's topic is drug development, AI, and saying no. Welcome, Christian. Welcome, Andrea. Can you tell us about your field? What field do you specialize in, Andrea?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we're doing drug development. So basically, one of the things we do is we quantify protein-ligand interactions. That's like a very general thing. The particular scope of my project is that we try to find a method in which the part of the designing of the drugs is going to actually be faster, because right now it takes a lot of time. So we're diving into that.
And Christian, what is your research field
so actually
about?
Something really similar. Mm-hmm. So in my case, I'm also trying to quantify protein ligand interactions, but I'm going with a little different approach. So what I'm trying to do is make a computer understand these interactions. So basically what I'm doing right now is I'm developing a protein ligand interaction descriptor. So basically, I'm just trying to get all the information to numbers and these numbers to get in the computer that it understands.
Okay, and I heard the word protein a lot, so I was just wondering, why is it important to study proteins, actually?
So basically, proteins are the main agents of biological function in our bodies. So we're not talking about proteins that we eat, but proteins that our bodies have or create. Mm-hmm. So there are many diseases correlated to the activity or lack of activity of these proteins. And one thing that must be said is that proteins do not actually work in isolation. They always are interacting with something else. It can be another protein. It can be DNA, RNA, small molecule, a small ligand. So these interactions are the ones that are mediating the metabolic pathways and the cellular processes. So it's important to actually get those regulated. Because in that way, then we can control how our body is responding and some of the metabolic pathways.
Okay, interesting. And the other word that I was hearing a lot is ligand. So what is it?
Yeah, well, a ligand can be pretty much anything and everything. So generally speaking, if you have a protein and you want to have a drug, for example, so some form of drug that wants to inhibit or maybe even like improve the functioning of this protein, then you have like a small molecule, for example, then you just throw it on the protein, and if it binds there, then you have like a protein ligand binding. So pretty much it's like the opposite part of the protein, like in layman's terms. So yeah, and of course, it's really important in the field to actually have these ligands and actually find these drugs, because of course, if it doesn't bind to a protein, if it doesn't interact with a protein, it basically does nothing, right? So basically, what we're trying to do is we try to find selective and ligands that have a high affinity. And affinity, just to make it clear, is the fact that it sticks to the protein pretty much. So we can't say anything about the biological relevance and stuff like that. Just this tries to stick to the protein.
Okay, so you talked about proteins and ligands. But what about the activity of proteins? Can proteins be active or inactive, and can they somehow be related to certain diseases? Andrea?
Yes, of course. So there are several examples. One that comes to mind is, for example, Huntington's disease. It is caused by a mutation in the Huntington gene, which is also called HTT. So what happens is when the protein is expressed and it aggregates being a mutant, it leads to neuronal degeneration. So it has been proved that the interaction between HTT and another protein, which is called GTI1, mediates disaggregation. That means that the protein GTI1 can prevent the aggregation of the HTT. So that would also mean that GTI1 has a potential for therapeutic strategies against Huntington's disease. So if we regulate the activity of one, then we can prevent the other one from aggregating, and then we can prevent this neuronal degeneration. Another example is the protein with which I am working. So it is called BRD4, and it has been shown to promote the growth and the survival of cancer cells. These cancer cells are, for example, leukemia, lung, and breast. So what we are actually studying right now is using small molecule inhibitors that bind to the domains or to certain parts of this protein BRD4. And then we can regulate its activity. So then if we turn off BRD4, then we can potentially stop the tumor growth, and we can even, like, not even stop it, but we can also get rid of the tumorous cells.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that is really weird with all this stuff, of course, is if you actually have like cancer as like an illness, this is classified as like rapid growth cells. You have like the problem with like just that the cells grow without a warning. But this doesn't mean which kind of cells, this doesn't say which kind of protein. So pretty much we're talking about like an all-encompassing term there. So pretty much you can't really say this specific protein is correlated to cancer as a whole, because cancer as a whole is very, very diverse.
Yes.
Which means we have like many proteins, many types of cancers. So this is makes this problem even way more complicated.
Okay, and jumping into our topic, now that we're talking about diseases, can anybody of you, maybe Andrea, explain to us how the whole process of drug designing actually works?
So how the process of drug design works is that first you pick a protein that you know has some correlation to one disease that you want to study. And then what you have to do is to find one high affinity ligand. And as Christian mentioned before, that means this is a molecule that is going to bind very strongly and very specifically to the protein that you're studying. Then you try to synthesize this ligand. It's usually not just one ligand that you synthesize, but you get like a group of ligands. And then you synthesize them. Then you actually test the activity of it against the protein that you're studying. And these tests may be carried first in the lab, but afterwards, then maybe you can test with animals and finally with humans. And it's a long and complicated process, as you can see, because it takes a lot of steps and there are a lot of people involved in the whole of it.
And yeah. Yes, it is a very long process, as you mentioned, and I can imagine that a lot of things can go wrong.
Oh,
so,
yes.
Christian, can you give us an example?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, with like the drug development process, because it takes this many years, so many things can go wrong. I mean, it all starts with just trying to find, you have a target, you know this protein, for example, leads to an illness, and you want to find something that has an affinity to this. Now, first of all, it's not said that just because you think, hey, this might have an affinity, that it actually has an affinity on the target. Then even after that, even if after you've proven, yes, it has an affinity to this protein, it doesn't mean that it's true in cells as well, or then in like animals or humans. It's like a completely different environment every time. So basically, if you find out, like, let's say you have a really promising ligand, it has high affinity, you study it in cells, it's amazing, you love it. And then you find out, well, like in the body, it doesn't do anything. You basically scrap this whole
thing. Oh,
no. You go back. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you, like, years of work just flushed on the toilet, basically. And then you have to restart. Maybe you have like another idea, maybe another modification that you can do. But still, this is an iterative process that you actually have to do like every time. Then you find out, okay, that might work. No, it doesn't. But this might. No. This. Oh, maybe. Huh. Well, next
yeah,
step.
Yeah, that's cool. Very long.
Oh, yeah. So, and of course, it might also not be selective. So maybe it actually is really good with binding on the thing. Maybe it actually does what you want. But then you find out, well, it also binds on like these 3,000 other proteins. And they are actually correlated to stuff you don't want to inhibit. Or even worse, yeah, it's just toxic, like plain toxic.
Yes, that can happen.
Yeah. So this will and does take years.
Andrea, I wanted to ask you about a whole process of drug design. So in what part of this process are you actually involved?
We're at the very beginning. We are doing just the drug design. So we're like at the part where we pick a protein and we are finding some ligands and doing those studies. But everything that is pertained to the synthesis and the maybe we're also involved a little bit in the testing activity, but just like in the lab, not with human beings and not with even animals. We're very, very at the beginning. So we are actually the ones who are obtaining and characterizing the proteins. So we are hence spending long lab days expressing them and putting the ligands in solution with them and actually taking a look and how they are interacting and how well the interactions are going.
Very interesting. And I wanted to ask both of you, how may your projects actually help us to be prone to less diseases, and how can they actually help communities? Maybe Christian, you can start.
Sure, gladly. So basically, what I'm doing in my project, as I already mentioned before, is I try to quantify protein ligand actions. This I'm doing by so-called GRAIL maps. And since I'm assuming most people haven't heard of this, because I haven't heard of this before I started working with it, this is a thing that's based on pharmacophores, which is another thing I haven't heard about before. So pretty much this is just a way to describe in a computer to some form of molecular interactions. So you might have a hydrogen bond somewhere, then you have an acceptor feature and a donor feature, then you can just make the computer know this thing does hydrogen bonds. It's as easy as that. And with this GRAIL maps, you can scan through a whole protein or maybe a binding pocket, depending on how you precise you already have the knowledge of this, so that you can then estimate different interactions at different points. And this stuff I'm actually using to develop a machine learning descriptor to actually then predict binding affinities. So basically what I'm trying to do is I want to quantify the protein and ligand interactions and then make the computer understand how they work and then make it learn how the affinity correlates to this. And the really important part there is, of course, if you have let's say another pandemic hits, then you have you find out, okay, that's the protein that you want to have. But an important first step is just to see if an already existing medication might work against this. And there you have millions and millions of compounds in databases lying around in pharmaceutical industry and publicly available as well. Then you can just scan through this very rapidly to see, okay, is there maybe the option that one might work? So that's actually what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to develop a very fast method there. It doesn't have to be too accurate. Of course, it should be as accurate as possible. But the main thing is speed in that case.
Okay. Thank you, Christian. What about you, Andrea?
So my project is basically trying to find a method in which we can quantify protein ligand interactions. And you may think there are plenty of methods to do that. Yes, but there are not very many methods to do that at atomic resolution. So what we're trying to do is by NMR designing one method that will allow us to actually have the energetic contribution, so that would be enthalpy and entropy of the binding of a protein and a ligand. And this, since we are doing it by NMR, we could actually get into atomic resolution. So that would help us get a better idea of which pair of atoms are interacting between the protein and the ligand. And that will help us make better ligands and understand better the interactions and to have drugs designed faster and better. So in some way, it is also the aim to have speed, but it is also accuracy.
Well, this is really, really impressive. And I'm guessing that there is a huge amount of data that is needed to do this kind of studies that you're doing. So, but where do you actually get this data from, Christian?
Oh, yeah. Well, there are many options, actually. So there are huge databases available online. So the stuff I'm usually using is PDBBind, which is a subset of PDB, which is the protein data bank. So you have 3D structures of proteins, you have a binding affinity that's correlated to this, so you can use this. But of course, there is much information available, but still we need much more because we're talking about stuff that's really data hungry. So, for example, if we're thinking about machine learning models that are maybe more known like ChatGPT, this is trained on so many different words and so many different sentences and books and articles and stuff like that. And this is why it's that good and that accurate. But we're talking about the order of magnitude of a few thousand compounds there. So we would need a lot of more data. But this is very, very time consuming.
I can imagine that. But where does that information come from?
So there's two ways that you can get this information on proteins. So you can either extract proteins from their natural source. So for example, if you're talking, I worked before with scorpion venoms, you can actually get the scorpions and get the proteins from there, but the purification processes are very complicated and you end up with very tiny amounts of protein. Or the other thing that you can do is express recombinantly the protein. That means you put the DNA in a bacteria and the bacteria expresses it for you. And then you can have it specifically expressed, so you will get higher quantities. And since you designed the gene that you put into the bacteria, then the protein is easier to purify because you can add some characteristics. However, it's difficult to establish the methods and the variables to optimize because many things can happen. The protein may not be soluble. The protein may not have the appropriate folding. You may seem that you have like a appropriate chromatography method to do something, and for some reason it may have similar molecular weight proteins that are getting purified along with yours. So there are many things that can go wrong, and this adds up for very long work days very frequently. And of course, once you already have your protein, you only have done half of the work, because you still have to get the information on it and process it. And that also may add up to weeks or months of work.
Oh, that seems to be like a huge challenge to obtain purified protein. And because you still have to do the protein characterization step, how actually are you able to get the protein structure? So do you have to process all this information by yourself, or and how time consuming is that?
I mean, usually, yes, you need to do this by yourself, but there are some automated and also machine learning methods to make this process a little faster. So yeah, basically you got to do this, but yeah, this also suffer from the same problem as we already talked about. So just a lack of data. So we need more training data for this to be more accurate. People actually then use more sophisticated models that actually are more data hungry.
And so what is the reason for this lack of data? So do you have access to data from all over the world, from every company, or what might be the reason for that?
I mean, that's the thing. So with like all over the world, yes. And there is open source databases. But of course, there's also industry data that they are not willing to share, because of course, this would then again lead to the fact that people can develop it maybe better. Maybe some industry secrets will come out. So they don't really have an interest to share this usually.
And the other thing that has to be said is that it's very time consuming to actually populate these databases. Because of everything that I explained before, it's difficult to get the proper procedure to purify the protein. And then once you establish it, to get all the information, it can take up to months. So populating the databases takes longer and longer. Of course, the obtainment and the processing of the experiments that will lead to the protein structure also take quite some time. And as Christian mentioned, this issue of the companies not sharing their confidential research for their own interests. And in the end, this doesn't allow the scientific community to get more information and to do research faster.
You also mentioned AI that you use to process your data. So how does that work, and what's the advantage and disadvantages of using it?
Well, simply put, they make you work faster.
Uh-huh. So interesting.
Quite easily, you just say, okay, you have aid, basically. It's just another tool. Of course, it's like every tool, it has its advantages and disadvantages. And for more complex problems, this usually doesn't work. So at least one model doesn't work. So one approach there is that you need like multiple different machine learning models that are actually very specialized in one thing. So you might ask ChatGPT to improve your English, for example. But then you wouldn't ask ChatGPT to actually calculate something for you, because this is just not what it can do. But then if you like actually put together these different micro models, you have like a very high accuracy for a very specific task, which makes the whole task better. And I mean, one thing that I really enjoy like mentioning in that like context, for example, there's another field of study called MD simulations. There you actually try to calculate how different molecules move over like a period of time. And there you need, of course, the forces that are acting on the different atoms and stuff. And you calculate this via a so-called potential energy surface. And this potential energy surface is like based on classical mechanics, which is like a very crude approximation. But now, if you have like machine learning methods, you can actually use quantum mechanical data to then train this model and then create such a potential energy surface, which should, in theory, make it more accurate.
Okay, that's a very interesting and very complex topic, and I'm a bit confused with all this concept. What is the difference between machine learning and AI?
So pretty much like machine learning is a part of AI. So this is like a subset, but usually it's used pretty interchangeably. So I don't think it's something you need to worry about too much, but it's like in the same field.
Yeah, and for example, I have also been using some AI. And there's this program that actually helps us assign the NMR spectra. So you can imagine it as a 3D cube that has a lot of spots in it, and every spot corresponds to an interaction between atoms. So we would have to interpret that by ourselves, and we do, and we know how to. But when we use AI for that, it makes the process so much faster. So I'm working with two proteins, and with one, I used this program, and then I just double checked that everything it had done was done properly. And I just made small corrections. But for the other one, I didn't have the chance to use the program for some reasons. And the process just took 1 month longer to actually get completely done. So I would say it's extremely useful. Of course, AI should be used with caution and double checking the results all the time. And one interesting thing is that I actually got to talk with the guy who developed this program or this AI. And one of his main inputs was, we need more information to actually train the AI with, because the more information we have, the more precise it can be. But we also need high quality data for that, because if you just put trash in, then you're just going to get trash out. And we cannot do like simulated data for the program. We have to do like actual data. So, yeah.
So, this seems to be highly interesting, but also I have the impression that it is there is a very important limitation, that there is this lack of data. Mm-hmm. And how can you actually use AI and include all kinds of AI approaches to that are currently under development? How can you include this into your analysis?
Yes, there is lack of data, and yes, we're looking forward always having more information with which we can build more, and with which we can have faster methods to do everything. And that's precisely why both our projects are focused on getting more data at a higher speed and data that is more precise.
Okay, thank you very much. That was all very interesting, but I wanted to ask you, changing to a more life-related topic. You mentioned that this process can take a long time, right? So you have long days in the lab. So how do you actually manage those?
Well, I would say you have to find your own balance. But for example, the days that I have to purify protein, I like to do everything in just one day. So it usually is 8 to 10 hours. So those are going to be my long days. And I know that. So I try not to do that on Fridays. But I try to do it before Friday, or I try to do it on Mondays when my mind is a little bit more at ease and I can actually like take the mental load to deal with it. So I would say I also mentally prepare myself. I make sure that I have like a good night of sleep before, so that I can arrive with energy and I can face a long day. You know, you wear comfortable clothes, you wear sneakers, like your favorite pair of sneakers that are super comfy, because you know that you're going to be standing up for a long time.
Andrea, that sounds like that you have really a lot of responsibilities in the lab. I wanted to ask, what is the opinion of your PI about your schedules? I mean, do you have to stay every day for 10 hours in the lab, or how do you deal with this?
So my PI has actually been very flexible with me. So he encourages me to stay as long as possible so that the work gets done. But at some point, I also knew that I had to have the difficult conversation with him and to ask him to have some flexibility on my schedules. And he was very hearing and very flexible to actually listen to my requests. And we managed to find a schedule that suits the best for everyone in here. So I would say that this is important, and I knew that this was a conversation I should not avoid, and it was scary and everything, but I needed to stand my ground and to tell him, hey, I need a little bit more, like sometimes I need to arrive a little bit later, or sometimes I will need to stay a little bit longer. And actually standing my ground and telling him all of this was very satisfactory for me, because then I got the chance to say to actually get a timetable that fits my personal needs and with which I know that I am at no risk of burning out or anything.
Is there a specific time at which you have to be in the lab, Andrea, or how do you plan or schedule your day?
Yeah, I had this conversation with my boss, because I really, really like my slow mornings. They help me maintain myself motivated and have a more balanced and relaxed day, so I'm less rushed. It was a difficult conversation, and when he said like, yeah, but maybe I will want you here from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., it was so hard to say no. I was like, okay, but I really have to stand up for myself. And I told him, I'm sorry, no, I can be here from 10 to 5, from 10 to 7 some days, but I will not sit on this because I also need to look after my mental health. And otherwise I will be at a risk of burnout, or, and then I'm not going to be productive. And then it's just going to be the opposite of the result that we actually wanted. And I'm happy that I actually said no to him, because in this way, we both found a way in which we could have a nice balance with my time in the lab that helps us get the project on time.
Yeah, that's actually very important. And in general, as a PhD, you have to have this conversation with your PI. I think for mental health reasons, it's really important.
Definitely.
And Christian, do you have any strategies to make sure you leave early?
Yes, actually I do. Basically, of course, if you're in the field of computational like research, then usually you're spending your day programming. You're spending your day just staring at the screen, maybe then having a bug, trying to find out what it is, and then you can basically hit your head against the same problem for like hours or maybe even days. And then at some point, of course, it just makes sense to say, okay, I need to stop this for the day. I need to get out. I need to get like a fresh mind and look at the problem from a different angle. And like one way I like to do this is just to have actually stuff scheduled afterwards. So for example, I do have a sports course like twice a week now, where I just know, okay, this is going to start at that time. And whatever happens, I'm trying to make it. So that I actually have like some stuff that is actually forcing me to get out there and to basically stop with the work. Because of course, like the main advantage of like having the computational part in there is the flexibility, right?
Yeah.
So you can do home office, you can do stuff like that. You can basically work from everywhere. But the main disadvantage is exactly the same. You can work from everywhere and all the time, which means pretty much whenever I'm home, I could also just log in, do some quick stuff. But I need to force myself to be like, okay, I'm having my sports course now, I'm going, and afterwards there won't be any work anymore. And next day I'm going to start fresh.
Thank you very much, Christian and Andrea, for all this very insightful information about what your projects are about and drug designing and AI and the importance of saying no. Sometimes this conversation can be hard, but it's necessary.
Yeah.
Can you just summarize in some concluding remarks for our listeners?
Yes, of course. So I would say the takeaway should be that drug design is a very long process that involves a lot of people. So this is for sure a team effort. We are just involved in the very beginning, and we are hoping that our works will help other scientists to develop faster and more efficiently and more accurately drugs. So we also hope to find more efficient drugs so more diseases may be cured.
Yeah, and of course, as a PhD, you can be at the lab for a very, very long time, if that's what you want to do. But of course, that's not the only way to do things. So if you're actually noticing that you can't handle this, it's also completely fine to say, no, you can't do this. And it's better for you, for your project, and for everyone involved. So, and of course, there's also much flexibility in this field. For example, I started as a chemist originally, so I was really doing lab work, and now I'm basically just doing programming. So you can actually choose the path you like to do.
Yes.
Thank you, Christian and Andrea, for sharing your experiences and expertise with us today.
Yeah. No worries. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Life Sciences and Science Life. We are your hosts, Sarah
and Agnes. Tune in next month for more intriguing science topics, relatable PhD experiences, and experts' contributions on how to navigate the career path of a young scientist. Next month's episode will be about building bridges through bioengineering with ERIM from the Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences. This is a podcast of the University of Vienna's Doctoral School of Pharmaceutical, Nutritional, and Sport Sciences.
Don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn.
Thank you for listening. See you next time.